Today I'm going to be talking about single channel condo impurity in the large spin limit. This is work I've been doing with Max at MIT, and hopefully there will be a paper out on the archive soon. Feel free to interrupt at any point if you have any questions. So first let me start off by introducing the single impurity condo problem. So the problem is described by the following Hamiltonian. Here we have a Hamiltonian for free electrons, and we have a coupling between the spins at site zero, the fermion at site zero, to an impurity spin by some condo coupling J. We take the magnitude of the impurity spin to be S. In a lot of experimental cases, S is taken to be a half. This problem is one of the first examples of strongly coupled physics. It was first understood through perturbation theory in J by Kondo in 1964. Later, Wilson studied it with numerical RG. And finally, it was exactly diagonalized by the beta ansatz by Andre Wiegmann and others. Experimental signatures of the Kondo effect include a resistance minimum as a function of temperature, and under-screening of the impurity at low temperatures. So I'll briefly show some of those experimental results. So here, this is the first experimental measurement of the Kondo effect. It was done in 1934. As you can see, there is a resistance minimum at about 4 Kelvin when the resistance was measured in different samples of gold wires. Here, this increasing part is the usual phonon contribution to the resistivity, and this increasing part as you lower temperature presumably comes from the impurity. More recent experiments, as in last year, show the screening of the impurity. This is a plot of the effective magnetization of the impurity as a function of the applied magnetic field. EZ here is the Zeeman splitting, which is proportional to the magnetic field. This black curve is the prediction for the zero temperature magnetization as a function of applied field. As I'll talk about later in the talk, the magnetic field H acts as an IR cutoff. And so for lower magnetic fields, you go closer to the strongly coupled fixed point. And for larger magnetic fields, you go closer to the weakly coupled fixed point. And here you can see that in the weakly coupled regime, this measured magnetization is about a half. And in the strongly coupled regime, the measured magnetization is about zero. So the spin is screened as you get closer to the strongly coupled fixed point.
What is being measured here?
This is the
NMR?
That I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember the exact experimental technique. The standard way of solving the Kondo problem, which we'll also use, is reducing this d-dimensional Kondo problem to 1D. If the way we do this is as follows: we take the Fermi surface to be spherical, and we also assume S wave scattering off the impurity. So that means that each incoming wave contributes equally to each outgoing wave. And so we can group incoming waves and outgoing waves of the same energy and label them as left and right movers. And doing so, we get the following 1D action for the Kondo problem. So here, the theory is defined from 0 to infinity because we are separating left movers and right movers, and our x-coordinate is the radial distance from the impurity. So here is the action for the Kondo problem on this folded real line. We could also unfold the action. We could either take psi L to be psi R of minus x, or psi R to be psi L of minus x to define an unfolded action along the full real line. And so here, you can already see this sort of setup seems to maybe lend itself to using boundary conformal field theory. This is a picture of the qualitative phase diagram for the Kondo problem. For J less than zero, we have ferromagnetic couplings. For J greater than zero, we have antiferromagnetic couplings. And these are the two fixed points of interest. Ferromagnetic perturbations are irrelevant, marginally irrelevant. They flow back to the weakly coupled fixed point. Whereas antiferromagnetic perturbations are they're marginally relevant, and so they flow to the strongly coupled fixed point. So we understand pretty well analytically the
ferromagnetic fixed point is just unstable.
Oh, so at J equals minus infinity? Yeah, that's unstable. So we have a very good understanding analytically of the behavior of the this problem near the weakly coupled fixed point and the strongly coupled fixed point. For the weakly coupled fixed point, we can just use perturbation theory in J, and that was done by Kondo in 1964. And we end up with the following beta function for J. And this is the quadratic flow that I was mentioning earlier, that's shown above, near J equals zero. And as J increases, this perturbation theory becomes more and more uncontrolled. And so this only holds for J near zero. Yeah.
So how does this depend on S?
S? Right, so if you, I think here you would replace J with SJ.
Well, at least to first order in the RG equation.
Oh, so here this doesn't, this RG equation doesn't depend on S.
Okay.
It it drops out of the RG equation.
Only to this order.
To this order, yes. In more generally, well, I'll keep the factor of S so that it's apparent later on in the talk. So we can also access the strongly coupled fixed point by going directly to the strongly coupled fixed point and understanding the physics and then thinking about the irrelevant operators at the strongly coupled fixed point. So here, let's take a discrete version of our Kondo Hamiltonian and consider the limit when J is much bigger than T, which is the hopping strength. In this limit, this Kondo coupling dominates. And if we expand this Kondo interaction term as follows, we see that the fermion at the site of the impurity binds with the impurity in such a way such that the resulting spin is S minus a half in order to minimize that term. And so here, if the impurity state were aligned in the Z direction, you could use the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients to figure out what the impurity state would look like once it binds to the electron there. The remaining electrons cannot enter the impurity. Doing so would increase the spin at the impurity and therefore cause a increase in this term that's proportional to Js. Or they would, or if you try to add another electron to further lower the spin at the impurity, you would violate Pauli exclusion. So at the strongly coupled fixed point, we have an impurity spin of magnitude S that is screened to S minus a half. And the remaining electrons see a hard wall at the impurity. This fixed point can be characterized, was characterized already with boundary conformal field theory by Ian Affleck and others in 1995. And the way you do so is by considering the first or the first few irrelevant operators at the strong coupling fixed point and using those to compute the low temperature observables. I will note that for S equals a half and S greater than a half, the behavior at the strong coupling fixed point is different. For S equals a half, this is actually just a singlet state. And so at the strong coupling fixed point, there is actually no spin that can couple to the spin currents of the fermions. And so the allowed irrelevant operators is qualitatively different than if S were greater than a half. For S greater than a half, there exists a spin operator that can couple to the spin currents of the fermions.
But it's ferromagnetic, that's
Yes, it is ferromagnetic. And I'll talk about that later too. So how do we access the intermediate scales in our RG flow? This was first done exactly by the beta Ansatz solution. This solution exactly diagonalizes the beta Ansatz Hamiltonian, and it produces up to numerical precision thermodynamic quantities such as the free energy and derivatives of the free energy. And here, this is a plot done in 1989 for S up to 7/2 of the specific heat as a function of temperature at zero field. The getting these types of plots requires solving recursive convolution equations. And so there is some limit based on your computing ability of how many spins you can go up to. I will later show plots for S greater than 7/2 to compare to our results. All right, so at the intermediate scales, we can use the beta Ansatz to get the observables that we're interested in numerically, such as specific heat, susceptibility, impurity entropy, et cetera. However, analytic expressions and a qualitative understanding of what happens at the intermediate scales is currently lacking because there's no nice closed form that you get from the beta Ansatz. So the question that we're trying to ask is if there is a way to access these intermediate scales using different techniques than what was used previously. And
naive question.
Yeah.
Is there any sense in which the intermediate scale physics is universal somehow? I modified Hamiltonian a little bit.
I think the perturbations that you can, most of the perturbations that you can apply that would still make it the Kondo problem are irrelevant. So I think the general flow is still, the general flow should be the same. I think the perturbations you could apply, for example, would be instead of having a delta function potential for the impurity, you could have some finite width potential. And that might change the short range physics a little bit, but it wouldn't change the flow of the problem.
Yeah, there's only one energy scale, which is the Kondo temperature. And once you determine the Kondo temperature, everything's universal. Provided the Kondo temperature is much smaller than Fermi energy or other microscopic scales.
Okay.
So there is a condition that Kondo temperature be small.
Yes, yes, yeah, that's right. That's how we were able to reduce it to this 1D free fermion CFT by expanding around the Fermi surface.
When you're doing that, you're assuming J is small.
Yes.
But in fact, it's better than that. The Kondo temperature is usually much smaller than J. You only require the Kondo temperature to be small. That's good enough.
Right. Okay. So recent progress in boundary conformal field theory suggests that there might be another way of approaching the single impurity Kondo problem. This type of approach was first done to discover the extraordinary log universality class in ON models for boundaries and defects. And it was also applied to studying spin impurities in ON models. So here we have a spin impurity in an O3 or SO3 critical bulk. And the techniques in boundary conformal field theory, which I'll describe during the main part of my talk, were used to find the scaling dimension for the spins at large S. So the goal of this talk is to capture all scales analytically for large S using boundary conformal field theory techniques. And we'll do this by expanding in 1 over S for large S. So our strategy will first B, to consider the infinite S limit, and in this limit, the impurity spin is frozen. Then we will take S large and finite, and we'll compute the effective action for our problem, order by order in 1 over S, and restore the SU2 symmetry. Then we will use our effective action to compute the RG flow. And finally, we'll use our action, our effective action, and the RG flow to compute thermodynamic observables. So let's first start off by the infinite S limit. So in the infinite S limit, we're going to take S to infinity, but we'll keep Sj fixed. So this will allow us to, this will make sure that our, the term, the impurity action term, the impurity term in our action doesn't blow up as we take S to infinity. The spin action is just given by this Berry phase action. And as S goes to infinity, the fluctuations of the spin are suppressed. And therefore, at S equals infinity, we can take the spin to be frozen. And without loss of generality, we'll just take the spin to be frozen in the positive z direction. In this case, the upspins see a positive delta function potential at the impurity, and the downspins see a negative delta function potential at the impurity. And this problem we can just understand using traditional 1D quantum mechanics. So we have this Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian induces a phase shift between the right and left movers, and it will be an opposite sign phase shift for the upspins and the downspins. The exact form here is not super important. What's important is that for small sj, the phase shift is sj over 2, and that mapping will allow us to recover the result from Kondo in perturbation theory. And at large j, the phase shift goes to pi, and that should recover the strong coupling fixed point. And indeed, if I were to plug in pi for the phase shift here, we would get the same phase shift for both the upspins and the downspins. All right, so instead of writing this problem as right and left movers with a delta function potential, we can instead write the action, the frozen action, as right and left movers related by this boundary condition, slightly away from the impurity. And so these are the boundary conditions we'll use for this action. And this modifies the OPE between the right and left movers as follows. So here there's a plus here just because the right and left movers have opposite velocities, and the phase shift is encoded in the numerator.
So this is
the correct boundary condition because the effect of the delta function potential is to induce a phase shift between psi r and psi l slightly away from the impurity. We can think of this delta function potential acting exactly at zero, and then we can consider how psi l and psi r are related to each other slightly away from the impurity, and we'll exactly get this relationship.
Can I also obtain the denominator by considering coupling symmetry?
This denominator is just the same denominator from for free fermions, instead of a minus sign here, you have a plus sign because the left and right movers have opposite velocities. We could also, if we wanted to, we could work in the unfolded action. In the unfolded action, you would have just left movers, and then this x would be a minus x, and then you would get the same denominator that you'd expect from conformal symmetry, and the numerator would still exist from the phase shift. Any other questions? All right, so this is very finicky. Okay, we can also think about the boundary operators, the marginal boundary operators that exist in our theory. we'll assume that we have particle hole symmetry, so we won't consider operators in the charge sector. We'll only consider operators in the spin sector. So the operator is psi dagger sigma 3 psi tunes the phase shift of our action. So if we add some, if we add a term c times psi dagger sigma 3 psi to our action, for a small enough c, that will tune the phase shift from rho to rho plus c. Additionally, we can add terms that are psi dagger sigma I psi, and these have the effect of tilting the impurity spin. And in the boundary conformal field theory literature, these operators are referred to as the tilt. All right, so we have characterized what this theory looks like in the infinite spin limit. Now we can ask, what happens when we take S to be large and finite? How can we restore the SU2 symmetry, order by order and 1 over S? All right, so when S is large but finite, the frozen action breaks the SU2 symmetry. The spin now is dynamical, and so we can't take the spin to be frozen anymore. So we end up having to add on interaction terms between the spin fluctuations and the fermions, and also contact terms for the spin to restore the SU2 symmetry and to restore SU2 symmetry.
Is it clear that those are the only terms that you can add?
I think those are all the relevant terms we can add to order pi squared. So I'll list all the terms that we add, but I think there are no other terms that we could possibly add. I guess we could also add these terms, but these are exactly marginal in the frozen limit, and so all they would do is either tune the phase shift or tilt the boundary impurity. The other terms that I will show are important for the dynamics of the spins. All right, just to recap, the free spin action is this Berry phase term, and we will, in solving this problem, we will expand around the North Pole for our impurity spin. So this is what the Berry phase action looks like once we expand around the North Pole. This form will end up being important later on. Now we can ask ourselves how to restore the SU2 symmetry. And the way we do this is by considering fluctuations of the impurity spin and ask how they affect our fermions and the frozen action. So under an SU2 rotation, the fermions will rotate like this, and the frozen action will change proportional to the theta I as well. And the easy way to see that, if you don't want to go through the math of plugging in this psi, is by appealing to Noether's theorem. We know the bulk is SU2 symmetric, and so all of the effects should live at the boundary. And if we take Noether's theorem and integrate by parts, we should just recover this form for the change in the frozen action. And here, J is the spin current of the fermions. Now, once we have these terms, we can write down the interaction term for our action. This first term is given by the order theta terms above, and the second term is given by order theta squared terms that I won't go into how we derive them, but it's possible to derive them, and it ends up not actually affecting our results because it just provides a finite phase shift to a finite phase shift change. Now, the other ordered pi squared terms that we can add are contact terms. These are terms that involve pi, but not the spin boundary operators or the fermion boundary operators. The first term here, delta m pi pi squared, is a term that we add to our action to enforce that the effective potential for the pi fields don't violate rotational invariance. In fact, the effective potential shouldn't depend on pi. This term is regularization dependent. It depends on the UV cutoff or the regularization procedure you take, so we don't have to, so we don't compute this term, and it turns out not to have a role in the physics that we are looking at. This other term is a correction to the Berry-Phase spin term. And the way to see how this arises is by considering our considering the Kondo model on a finite system with these boundary conditions. Here, this is the frozen action boundary conditions from earlier. Here, this is a hard wall boundary condition that we choose for the following reason. We want there to be no level crossings in our spectrum as we tune the phase shift from 0 to pi. And this is exactly the boundary condition that allows us to enforce that. Now, if we take this the model on this system and with these boundary conditions, and we integrate out the fermions, for energies on the order of 1 over L, we end up getting a contribution from the interaction terms to the Berry phase. But here we're dealing with a finite system at zero temperature, and the Berry phase must be quantized. And so to restore Berry phase quantization, we have to add this contact term to our action.
So suppose you do consider this quantization, is there any other consideration that can lead to this delta SP?
It turns out that you can indirectly, so this delta SB will turn out to be important when we're computing the thermodynamic quantity observables. It turns out there is another way of computing those thermodynamic observables using the boundary G function, and using our beta function and the boundary G function that will reproduce the boundary entropy of our system. And you can see that delta SB must take this form to reproduce the boundary entropy that's given by the G theorem.
But suppose I don't know it. Suppose I just look at the effective field theory. How do I know that?
You're asking how would you know it existed, say, for an infinite system?
How do I know this is really an SU2 spin? I guess I just have to know it.
I think you just have to know it. I think it's because you know physically that that's the, like, you're writing the effective action for a spin coupled in this way to the metal. And so, I mean, that's how we know that we have the Berry phase action for the spin to begin with.
I guess maybe in a language you like, it's an anomaly. The coefficient of the very Bessel-Innowitten term is the simplest anomaly there is. This is a zero-dimensional WZW term. But both the quantization and anomaly only tells you it's an integer or half integer. Is it clear that you have to restore to exactly the original UV value?
That's, you can see from by continuity. If we start at rho equals 0, we know that the Berry phase must be quantized to be S. And so as we tune rho from 0 to pi, because there are no level crossings, the total Berry phase should still be quantized to be S. All right, so to recap, we've constructed our effective action to order pi squared. This is the Berry phase term for the free spin. These are the interaction terms, and these are the contact terms. All right, so now let's compute the RG flow induced by the spin fluctuations. And this calculation is pretty straightforward. We can just use standard Wilsonian RG. We integrate the modes with energies between some UV cutoff lambda and some energy scale slightly above that UV cutoff. This is the term that we get when we expand the interaction term to second order in pi, to second order in perturbation theory. Using the OPEs that I showed for the fermions and also the free spin OPE, we can reduce delta S int to this form. And here, this is exactly the operator that tunes the phase shift in the frozen action. So we know that this term delta S int must correspond to an increase in the phase shift by sine squared rho over pi s times delta L. And from here, we immediately get the beta function. And this is what rho as a function of our RG scale L looks like, where here rho naught is some reference phase shift that we take in the UV. If we wanted to take the temperature as an IR cutoff, we could write this expression for the phase shift. And we can use dimensional transmutation to define another reference scale at which the phase shift is pi over 2. And up to some order 1 factor, this is equal to the Kondo temperature, because the Kondo temperature tells you at which scale the perturbation theory in Jane is no longer valid. All right, so here is what this beta function looks like. Here we have the weakly coupled fixed point at rho equals 0. And if we substitute in our small j expression for the for rho, we end up reproducing Kondo's result for the effective for the RG flow for J. This order J cube term, I think, has a 1 over S factor, and so we're not able to get the order J cube term. At the strongly coupled fixed point, we again have a quadratic, it looks quadratic near the strongly coupled fixed point. And if we, say, were to extend this beta function over here, we would find a decreasing quadratic function over here corresponding to ferromagnetic coupling. And so here, we can think of the strongly coupled fixed point as, near the strongly coupled fixed point, as a spin S minus a half that is ferromagnetically coupled to the metal. So this reproduces a lot of the physics we already know about the Kondo problem. All right, so now let's use our RG flow, let's use our effective action, and compute thermodynamic observables for the Kondo problem. So the way we'll do this is by directly computing the partition function. Here, this is expanding, this is the expansion of the partition function to order 1 over s. Z frozen is exactly the bulk partition function for the fermions, and it has no rho dependence. It's exactly what you'd get for if you wrote down the free fermion conformal field theory partition function. And we know that Z frozen can't depend on rho because changing rho corresponds to an exactly marginal perturbation in the infinite spin limit. Z spin is just 2s plus 1. It turns out you can do the calculation that s squared int is equal to 0. And the contact term's contribution to the partition function is exactly parametrized by delta sb. So it turns out to be very important in calculating thermodynamic observables. Now, once you have this expression, this is to order, I guess, to plus some 1 over s terms over here. Once you have this expression, you can just directly compute the impurity entropy and the specific heat, which I'll show on the next slide. To order 1 over s, this is what the impurity entropy looks like. And here you can see that we've reproduced the behavior at the weak coupling and strong coupling fixed point that we expect. At the weak coupling fixed point, we have a free spin s, and at the strong coupling fixed point, we have a free spin s minus a half. And so we reproduce the expressions for the entropy that we would expect. And we can also take a derivative of the entropy with respect to log t, and we get the impurity specific heat. Now we can also consider couplings to a magnetic field to compute the susceptibility and the magnetization at zero temperature, which was the plot that I showed at the very beginning of the talk. The magnetic field couples to both, an external magnetic field couples to both the charge density of the fermion, or the spin density of the fermions, and also the impurity spin. But there's also this counter term delta S, or this contact term delta SM, which also arises from quantization requirements when you put the system on a finite, when you put this action on a finite system. If we take the same boundary conditions we considered earlier for the Berry phase when computing delta SB, and we compute the bulk spin density at any point in the interior of the system, we find that it's equal to rho over 2 pi L. And so we have an extra spin charge of rho over 2 pi that's smeared along the interior of our system. And since we have a finite system at zero temperature, spin must be quantized, which means that there must be some spin charge minus rho over 2 pi that resides at the impurity. Another way of deriving this result is by appealing to the Friedel sum rule for metals. So with this sort of renormalized spin, we can directly compute the susceptibility and the magnetization at zero temperature. So here's what the susceptibility looks like. As you'd expect, we recover both the free spin S susceptibility at the weak coupling fixed point and the S minus 1/2 susceptibility at the strong coupling fixed point. And again, this is what the zero temperature magnetization looks like. And we recover S and S minus a half. We can also think of our magnetic field as an IR cutoff because it's a dimension one relevant perturbation. And so we can also get an expression for the impurity magnetization as a function of magnetic field, which is exactly what that plot in the beginning was. But that was for S equals a half, not for large S. All right, now we can compare these results to the Beta-Ansatz results. At low and high temperature, our results agree with the Beta-Ansatz results for the specific heat and the susceptibility. Here, TK is the Kondo temperature. The exact definition depends on the Beta-Ansatz Hamiltonian, but the important thing is that the phase shift at the Kondo temperature is order one, and using that requirement, we can reproduce these asymptotic results. Additionally, if we take the expression for the zero temperature magnetization from the Beta-Ansatz and we simplify it using the assumption that S is much bigger than 1, we get a form that's very similar to our expression for the zero temperature magnetization. And so, as you can see on this slide, it's very similar to the Beta-Ansatz form, where if we set T0 equal to some other microscopic scale, T1, I will say that there are very many different microscopic temperature scales that are in the Beta-Ansatz solution, and a difficulty in looking at the past literature is parsing through all of these different conventions. So I think the exact values of what TK, T1, and this T naught M are not very important. What's more important is the form of the expressions here. And in fact, this simplification has an order 1 over S error, and therefore there would be a order 1 error in this log term over here, so we can't actually say that T naught is equal to 2T1. And finally, yes, there's yet another third scale that we have to use to compare numerical results from the beta ansatz to our results. So here is a plot of the zero temperature magnetization as a function of the magnetic field. We choose these axes such that this log h over t naught over s and m minus s such that m minus s such that all the plots have the same x and y axis. As s increases, you can see there's better agreement. Similarly, we choose nice axes for the specific heat, and as s increases, we get nice agreement as well. Finally, we do the same thing for susceptibility, and we get nice agreement. All right. In the last bit of my talk, I'll mention some future directions that you can take using some of our largest results. The first question you might ask is, can we get other Kondo signatures that we've seen experimentally? The first signature is the resistance minimum that I talked about at the very beginning. And there's a hint that we can get the resistance minimum because there is a related quantity, the magnetoresistance, the resistance at zero temperature but finite field, which we have an idea of its behavior, for which we have an idea of its behavior. We know that the magnetoresistance goes as cosine squared of rho qp, where rho qp is the quasi-particle phase shift in the beta ansatz. And if we assume that our phase shift is the same as the quasi-particle phase shift, then we can say that the magnetoresistance decreases with h. And so if we expect h and t to play the same role, then perhaps the impurity contribution to the resistance also decreases as a function of temperature from our results. Another referenced signature of the Kondo problem is the Kondo screening cloud. One of the signatures is that despite TK being very small, there is a larger screening cloud that you can measure experimentally. Here is an experiment that was done to measure the Kondo screening cloud. They placed a Kondo impurity and a barrier that was within the Kondo screening cloud to induce some sort of interference between the Kondo screening cloud and itself, and they measured the effective Kondo temperature as a function of this distance, and they showed that there are large oscillations in the measured Kondo temperature near the cloud, but as you go within one effective length scale away from the cloud, which turns out you no longer see these oscillations. So this is a direct measurement of the Kondo screening cloud.
So what does it correspond to in the language of set T?
That I'm not sure. That is a future direction. Another future direction is looking at higher dimensions. One such example is, instead of considering a single impurity, considering a antiferromagnetic chain embedded in a 2D metal. And there is a recent paper by Karen Grover's group that proposed this phase diagram using Hertz-Millis for the order on the spin chain. The question is, can we use our largesse technique to confirm this phase diagram? This problem is more difficult because there is a Fermi surface that we have to consider, but perhaps our largesse techniques could be used to solve this problem. Finally, another future direction might be transport in quantum dots. There was work done in the 1990s that about condo peaks in transport and quantum dots. Here we have a quantum dot with a single orbital that's coupled to a left and right lead, right lead. And this problem, you can exactly map to the condo problem if if U and epsilon naught, these parameters of the quantum dot, are parametrized correctly. And what you'll find is that if you look at the density states of the condo of the quantum dot, you will find a condo peak at the Fermi surface. And this is a manifestation of the condo effect. So that was a spin half quantum dot. It turns out that you can construct arbitrary spin quantum dots by, instead of having one active orbital, you have 2s active orbitals. And then you apply some sort of Hund's rule interaction to align the orbitals. And that would give you an effective spin s on the quantum dot. And indeed, people have measured the condo effect in a spin 1 quantum dot, and more recently in a spin 3 halves quantum dot. So perhaps some of our largest results could be used to understanding the transport properties in this type of system. So that's the conclusion of my talk. This is a summary. Thank you, and I'll leave it open for questions.
So can I apply it to study 2+1D free-Fermi
setting? So the question was about studying 2+1D free fermion CFTs.
Yeah.
I think there is a chance that you can play this a similar game where you consider a pinning field applied to the 2+1D free fermion CFT. And that's basically what we did over here. We apply a pinning field to this 1+1D free fermion CFT. And then, so you can apply a pinning field to the 2+1D free fermion CFT, and then ask what happens when you restore spin fluctuations. I don't know how either of those would work out if you actually did it, but perhaps you could use something like this to study that.
Yeah, actually, for free fermion CFT, the pinning field is irrelevant.
If in the case, right, so yeah, if it's irrelevant, I'm not sure if there still exists a strong coupling fixed point then. So, but if there exists a strong coupling fixed point, then you can do this. But I'm not sure if that exists.
Infinite J, presumably, you should still screen that.
Yes, just for a single, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And it's stable, right?
Yeah, but the RG flow may be more complicated. Probably some transitions.
So, for free fermion CFT and free fermion Fermi gas, the difference, I can say the difference is whether the density of states is finite. So coming from this angle, what can you say about the difference between these two setups?
So are you talking about, are you still talking about a single impurity?
Yeah.
So for a single impurity, you can do this mapping I described earlier from a metal with a Fermi surface to the 1D free fermion CFT. 1+1D free fermion CFT, where you group all the modes with the same energy that are incoming, group all the modes with the same energy that are outgoing, and label that as a left mover with a particular energy or a right mover with a particular energy. And then if you do this while expanding around the Fermi surface, then you end up getting this 1+1D action. If you introduce more anisotropies to the problem, then I'm not sure exactly how it would behave, because you no longer can assume S-wave scattering, you no longer can assume, you no longer might be able to assume that the Fermi velocity is the same everywhere on the Fermi surface.
Let's suppose there's no anisotropy. Say I have some graphing, I dope it, so I have Fermi surface. Now I de-dope it, I decrease the chemical potential to the charge neutrality point, to the semi-metal point, to the CFT point.
Mm.
This process, what's changing dramatically? It's the density of states, right?
I think it's the density of states, yeah.
Then this consideration of
Then I think you would have to go do what Yuchen was talking about with the 2 plus 1D free fermion CFT. I don't think you can map to the 1 plus 1D free fermion CFT.
Ninth one. I know you explained why it's not supposed to work that well for S equal to 1/2, but if I just take this large S result and push it to S equal to 1/2, how bad is it?
Oh, so I think the I think you can see it directly with the susceptibility. So if I were to just put in S equals 1/2 here, I would get 0 over T is also 0, so I'd get something that's indeterminate. What happens for S equals 1/2 as you go to 0 temperature is that the susceptibility becomes a constant. But that you can't reproduce with this sort of large S result. I think there are maybe some things that you can say that would carry through.
So you say you can reproduce?
You cannot.
Oh, you cannot.
Okay. Because this large S result assumes that you maintain this 1 over T form for susceptibility. Mm-hmm. So I think there may be some things that might carry over, but I'm not sure. I wouldn't trust any of these results for S equals 1/2 at the strong coupling fixed point.
So after the Kondo screening, this remaining S minus 1/2, deeper gradient just decouples?
At the strong coupling fixed point, it decouples. Near the strong coupling fixed point, it has a ferromagnetic interaction with the remaining.
So then it will have some physical consequence at that point.
Right, so that's how people computed low temperature quantities in this type of system beforehand. They looked at the residual for S greater than 1/2, they looked at the residual ferromagnetic interaction and they were able to compute the specific heat and the susceptibility at low temperatures. But for S equals 1/2, this leftover spin no longer exists, and so you have to go to the next lowest dimensional allowed operator to compute observables.
I see. And at the strong coupling fixed point, then I just have decoupled the gradient and the boundary safety.
Right.
Any other questions?
What about the multi-channel case?
Oh, yes, that is a very natural extension that you can make. I think my assumption is that you would be able to just do the same things that we did over here for a multi-channel case.
So you said you would or you wouldn't?
I think you would be able to.
You would, okay.
Because I think you can consider multiple flavors of fermions with this boundary condition and then compute the flow once you induce the spin fluctuations. I think it should be straightforward.
But there, can you get the non-fermion liquid fixed point this way?
Are you talking about for if you have more channels than the spin? Or are you talking about
because you're talking about fixing channel number and take the large spin.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's always, yeah, it was.
Yeah, the other limit, I'm not sure how that would, I don't think you could do this for the other limit.
The other limit is like a planar limit or coupling limit. It's completely unrelated.
Sure.
The large limit.
Yeah.
The Tolkhoff Hadron or Hadron?
Actually, just not.
Okay.
Okay, if there's no more questions, let's thank Abhishek.